Slate's audiobook club is brought to you by Fun Home, winner of 5 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. The Associated Press calls this groundbreaking production the best of what Broadway can do. Get tickets at funhomebroadway.com. And by audible.com, with more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook at audiblepodcast.com/slateabc. Hello, and welcome to this month's installment of the Slate Audiobook Club, where a rotating cast of critics discusses the books on everyone's minds. I'm your host, Katie Waldman, the words correspondent at Slate, and I'm joined today by Megan O'Rourke, writer and critic for many places, including Slate. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
And also by Parul Sehgal of the New York Times Book Review and the New York Times Magazine. Hello.
Hey, Katie.
We've got a great show for you today. We'll be discussing When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi, the memoir of a neurosurgeon who received a terminal cancer diagnosis at 36. In this graceful, learned, and moving book, Kalanithi charts his journey from doctor to patient and seeks out an understanding of what makes a virtuous, meaningful life. I should mention that he died in March of 2015. His book has since become a bestseller, with an epilogue by his wife, Lucy, and a foreword by the writer and doctor, Abraham Verghese. Something that surprised me about When Breath Becomes Air was the extent to which it was a textbook or an educational text. It delivered at least two types of knowledge. It straightforwardly told me things I didn't know, such as the fact that there is a verb, burk, for killing someone so that you can sell the body to medical students for dissection. And it made real and present things that I knew intellectually but had not entirely assimilated or appreciated with my whole being, such as the fact of mortality. So I thought it might be fun to start with each of us saying one thing this book taught us that we didn't really know or comprehend before.
I think in a more sort of like macro way, something I learned from this book is how much sometimes knowledge doesn't prepare you for things, right? Because here's somebody who intellectually had been, you know, studying death and been close to the body. And when it comes to his own body and his own death, how much does that help him in this book? I'm not sure.
Yeah, you know, there was a lot in this book that was actually sort of terrifyingly familiar to me. But even given that, you know, there is this way in which I think part of my fascination with the literature of death and dying and hospitals and illness comes from the fact that, you know, and he talks about this really, really eloquently, you know, even as you know that this is going to happen to you, even as it is happening to you, there is still this kind of these moments of intellectualizing, right? And these moments where in the book, he's very, very ill and has a terminal diagnosis. He's responding to the therapy and he starts to make 10-year plans where the reader kind of is thinking, wow, you know, this is, you know, we know the end of the story. So there's a real poignancy to it. So I thought that was one of the strengths of the book. And I've read a lot of cancer memoirs, and we can talk more about the genre later. But the medical stuff, just the part of him being a medical student and a resident and being a neurosurgeon, that was just wonderfully observed. And I loved that same detail you picked out, Katie, about the burk. I did not know about the burk, that to kill somebody in order to use their body.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was just, he has such a wide-ranging set of interests and such a ranging mind, too. I love that he was so excellent in his calling and his chosen profession as a neurosurgeon, but also so curious about everything else from literature to philosophy. I felt like he was trying, like you could feel his ambition to really paint as full a picture of human experience and of the world that he could. And I did end up feeling like this was a very satisfying and fulfilling book, and it was a very full book, like kind of stuffed to the brim.
It's interesting. I think, you know, for me, a couple of things really stuck out. And as you guys know, but maybe our listeners don't know, so I've written a book about grief and about my mother dying of cancer. And a lot of this book is actually about sort of the mechanics of cancer. She had a different cancer from the one that he had, and I'm not a doctor, but part of the experience that he captures so wonderfully that I think is true for a lot of people, whether or not you're a patient or a doctor. You know, one of his points is once you become a patient, you're no longer the doctor, right? Is just the way that you become immersed in this kind of vocabulary and procedural aspects of cancer that are very so, so difficult to deal with. And actually, there's another book out right now, Charles Bach's novel about a young woman dying of leukemia that I read just before reading this. And so I feel immersed in that world of cancer. I think, you know, one of the things that really that is unique about this book is its combination of being a patient narrative and a doctor narrative. Right, so that he is able to at once really talk incredibly eloquently about the doctor-patient relationship. And because, as you're saying, he was such a humanist, right? He studied philosophy, he wanted to be a writer, he loved poetry, there's a lot of poetry in this book. He really is a wonderful and I think probably highly unusual guide to the moral aspect of medicine. Right, which is an aspect we really don't talk enough about.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, I feel like I have a few more reservations about this book that I feel churlish bringing up. But, I mean...
No, I have some too.
And we'll get into that as respectfully as possible. But, I mean, so he has, as you both have said, so many different registers. There's the doctor, there's the patient, there's the sort of great lover of literature and poetry. And I mean, I think some of these registers are more successful than others. I think I love him on science. I love him on when he is in the lab, like sort of in the operating theater, when he's describing cutting into the brain. Those are some of the most incredibly beautiful passages I've read all year. You know, it's just because he's also not convincing us of its importance or its interest. He is interested in it. It's important to him. And those sections just flow for me. I think I had a little bit more trouble when he starts to plumb things for meaning, especially literature. I don't think he's as strong on sort of looking at what literature can teach us about dying and death and meaning. And there are parts of this book that gave me pause they feel narrated by his superego. Like a lot of the book for me feels like this is how I want to be remembered. You know, this is what I did. This is what I was not able to accomplish. A lot of the book, I mean, his great love affair is with his work. And so at least in my reading, you know, so the great quandary in the book is, okay, shall I return to work? Okay, now I'm working and I'm ill. How am I going to manage it? That's the great loss we feel. Like he's not going to be able to, you know, live according to this 40-year plan that he built, that 20 years as a doctor, then 20 years as a writer. And, you know, we see him grappling with that very honestly, very beautifully. And I'm not saying that he should have had different priorities. It's just, you know, I kept wanting it to go a little bit deeper. I wanted it to be, again, like a bit more of a messier book, you know? And I think wherever things get a little bit unwieldy and get away from him, which are those sections when he's talking about medicine, and as Megan pointed out, he's brilliant when he calls out other doctors. He's brilliant when he calls out himself for his callousness and how he's treated people. And right, and those are the sections where I was just like, oh, this is whom the world has lost. This is who, this is this great sensibility. This is the sense of candor. This is the sense. Whereas in other sections, I felt like that there's a certain kind of thinking being performed. And it felt a little, you know, and there's a, you know, we can get into the sort of more religious aspects of this book, but there are parts of the book that felt to me a little bit like a sermon, you know, and I was less engaged there.
Yeah, I think I was very much where you were, Carl, in the sense that, you know, maybe it's partly, I do feel very immersed in this literature, and I'm writing a book about illness and my own experience with illness, which is a very different kind of illness right now, and have thought a lot about the medical system and these issues of being a patient and doctor and the really broken, corroded patient-doctor relationship. And again, I really think he has so much to offer there. And I felt like there was this incredible kind of shadow book in this book that you could imagine if he hadn't died, that he would one day have written, right, which would have been a book about being a doctor and would have been just an inestimable contribution, I suspect. He's a humanist and a scientist, and actually in our specialized age, that's really rare. That said, I agree with you. I didn't feel like the poetic or the moments of literary analysis were the sharpest part of it. And I think that, you know, part of what I was getting at with the 10-year, you know, when he's thinking, oh, here's my 10-year plan is, you know, one thing we need to acknowledge is, yeah, he died while having just started this book, you know, and he wrote it while he was really sick. And it does feel like that to me, right? It feels like there would have been another layer of going through and working on the, probably, who knows? We don't know what it would have been. But, you know, I can imagine the book this might have ended up becoming, and there are moments where the book is that. And then there are these moments that feel more, as you're saying, where he's still kind of in the world of the everyday mind, being like, here's my plan, and not quite I kind of wanted a little more recognition of or grappling with on the page of actually what it was going to mean to die. And I actually thought one of the interesting things about this book is there's a lot of planning, and there actually the writing about mortality, there's not actually that much of it. And some of the most powerful parts of it come at the very end where he writes to his daughter, and he really knows at that point he's going to die, but it's very, very short.
Yeah, and can I just say, I'm sure people read this, but I just wanted to remind people of this. You wrote an amazing essay for the Times Book Review in 2013 called Deadlines, which people are looking for other memoirs about, especially writers writing about their own deaths. And I think there you also sort of look at, I mean, I don't think you wrote about scientists. You wrote about Updike, Christopher Hitchens, Marjorie Williams, and a few other people. I think there you also get into the artistry of this. Because, I mean, it is a record of something, but it is also a work of art. It should also stand as a work of art, you know? There you sort of get into it. And I would also recommend Katie Royce's book, her new book, The Violet Hour, on how people did, and, you know, writers like from Freud to Sontag didn't sort of embrace their own deaths. Just because, I mean, I think one of the most powerful things I got out of this book was that, you know, we die very idiosyncratically and like everyone else. And it's a very strange thing, you know, the way he dies. Like, I mean, the theme that sort of keeps going through this book is that he's a striver, right? Like, human beings aren't perfectible, but we can strain towards this asymptote. Even Lucy, Colin P's wife, and this afterward, I thought was just incredible, talks about it too. She says, this is a very solitary book. You know, we don't really get this, you know, Paul doesn't talk about his family or his friends. We don't get a sense of his, you know, sense of humor or his capaciousness. It really is just, you know, him and his thoughts in this lonely way. But, we do see him planning and sort of striving for meaning and striving for a good death and trying to take care of her. And, you know, that's his way. And at the same time, at the very end, it's just like everybody else.
This episode of Slate's Audiobook Club is brought to you by Fun Home. Fun Home is the winner of 5 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. Based on Alison Bechdel's acclaimed graphic memoir, this groundbreaking Broadway musical tells a refreshingly honest story about seeing your parents through grown-up eyes. The Daily News calls Fun Home an uplifting musical drama of rare intensity, honesty, and beauty that speaks universally about big things that matter: life, love, family, surviving. Get tickets at funhomebroadway.com. Getting back a little bit to, you know, his different registers and how he is both a doctor and a humanist, I did feel that he sort of writes like a surgeon. I loved when he kept using the verb unzip, like the fluidity and ease with which the flesh unzips under the knife or something. And it seems like when he's writing really well, he has this kind of clear and elegant and direct and fast tone. Like he gets in and out, and it flows, and it sounds like a surgeon is writing very precisely and very well. And in the same way that I felt like his doctorness kind of suffused everything, I also thought that I actually sort of enjoyed the first part of the book, maybe a little bit more than the second part. Maybe it just felt a little bit less ragged because he had had more time to work on it. But there is a way in which knowing what was coming colored sort of all the opening parts of his life that he was using as sort of table setting. And for instance, I was thinking about that moment when he goes out to explore Arizona. He grows up in Arizona, and it's just this hot desert. And he opens up an irrigation grate and sees these black widow spiders. And to me, that was just such a interesting, probably unintentional, but, you know, you open up the surface and inside is this kind of poisonous mass, and there's the hourglass on their backs. And to me, I was thinking, oh, that's the cancer. You know, you peel off the surface of the skin and then there's the toxicity underneath, like the sort of writhing death. And it just, I wish that he had actually had more anecdotes like that that we could sort of use as gateways into the meaning that he's trying to deliver, as opposed to him just talking about the meaning on its face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's another really great scene with the spider where he talks about how he and his friends used to dangle ants over the wolf spider's nest to coax it out. You know, so I agree with you, anytime we get like a scene or something that isn't obviously linked to cancer or to medicine, suddenly we get to see a whole other side of him that sort of makes him more real and sort of, you know, more interesting, because I feel like the book sort of flounders at parts when he sort of states things explicitly. For example, this is the sentence I flagged, that like he's talking about, so he and his wife decide to have a child before he dies, and this is how he describes his desire to have a child. He goes, if human relationality formed the bedrock of meaning, it seemed to us that rearing children added another dimension to that meaning. You know, so you get stuff like that, which is just so aloof and cerebral, and it's sort of like, you know, only in the afterward where his wife sort of gives us a scene where we see this child and we see him as a father and we sort of get a sense of, it's such a thing about the hope that we want to mourn him too a little bit. You know, we want to feel like what's been lost. And, you know, I felt like we missed some occasions to do that.
I mean, yeah, I agree. I think we really, you know, it is such a, afterward, his wife is wonderful and she says something that is not the book he was going to write. And I really did feel that as a reader. And Katie, as you're saying, that's such a kind of extraordinary, powerful moment with the Black Widow spiders and the kind of, I think he talks about the pearlescent facts that they have. And there are a few moments like that just really crystallize something about the tactility and intensity of this world also that he is leaving, right? And it does feel almost like this is notes, you know, again, this is notes toward the book he's going to write, and it sort of toggles in and out of that more clinical approach, which sometimes there's a precision to his writing that's really wonderful, and then sometimes there's still an abstraction where, you know, you feel this is a draft. But one thing that I found very interesting about this book is, and it's rare in my experience in reading kind of medical literature today, there's a lot of kind of gestural or other gestures toward, you know, the ethical aspect of medicine and bioethics and the moral aspect of medicine. But in a way, a lot of the bioethical literature and other literature doesn't really delve into the more deep moral aspects of medicine and the implications of the healthcare system where, you know, as he so powerfully portrays, you're just so overtired, right? You're so exhausted. Mm-hmm. You're so pressed for time. There's an extraordinary scene where one of his friends in medical school, you know, is on a rotation with him, and she's going into, you know, surgical oncology, and they're going into a very complicated surgery called a Whipple, which is for pancreatic cancer, which is a devastating cancer, usually kills you very quickly. And if it's not caught early, and she goes in, and it's a 9-hour operation at the end of the day, and she's so tired, she thinks, I really hope this patient has metastases, because if the patient has metastases, they don't do the operation. It also means the patient is probably going to die very imminently, right? And she has this thought, I really hope this, you know, when we open this person up, that there's cancer everywhere. And in fact, they open the woman, I think it's a woman, I can't remember, up, and there is cancer everywhere, and she feels relief. Right. And then she feels shame. And these moments like that he not only narrates, but then tries to connect to a larger vision of really this moral aspect of medicine that sounds so easy to say, but bizarrely is really not talked about when we talk about healthcare reform, right? And those moments were what made me just long for, you know, really feel the weight of his loss. And he seemed like an incredibly tenacious, you know, unusual person who was really determined to try to hold on to the human aspect of medicine in the face of that being kind of devastating for him, right? Day in and day out, to really face up to the losses that he was seeing. And I thought that was just kind of a moving testament to his character. You know, and again, this book is a funny thing because one doesn't want to be churlish about it. I do think there's limitations to it, limitations of circumstance. And that also, but then seeing these moments made me think, oh, I wish I could read the book he might have written.
Yeah, and I think he's also just honest about what brought him to medicine, you know, in a way that I haven't really seen. So, I mean, part of it is like, you know, this deeply humanitarian side, but a lot of it is the thrill of it. It's the excitement. You know, it's this high, and that's something that I haven't seen quite so openly discussed, you know, that intensity of it, and the power of it, the power of sort of like, he's got this long passage about going through and, you know, leading people through a forest or leading people, you know, since it's all the sort of complicated messianic stuff too, that does come out. And I agree with you. I mean, if he'd had more time, like, and if this hadn't had to be a memoir of like a very untimely death, this would have been, and parts of it still are, like a really, really interesting and unique, ferociously honest book about this profession.
I was just going to say that one part of his vision of an effective doctor is someone who is not only technically excellent, and he talks about the Greek word arete, so virtue, which is excellence in all things. But he also thinks that doctors are supposed to help patients come to an understanding of what's happening to them and sort of be almost a pastor. And I think at one point he says, if I were more of a religious man, I would have gone into the clergy, because what I want to do is stand at the intersection of life and death and see where, you know, consciousness flickers and dims, and I want to be at that threshold. And you're right, there's a tremendous power to that, but there's also this kind of metaphysical striving and a desire for, like, the most meaningful possible place that you can be in life. I guess to get back to the criticism of the book, like, feeling him constantly reaching for the most meaningful possible thing is frustrating because you can't always get there. But it did seem to be something that mattered to him more than it matters to the average individual. And that was a piece of characterization that was helpful to me reading the book.
One of the things that was interesting to me about this book that I haven't seen discussed a lot, which connects to what I've been talking about, is I do think that to be one of these really, really top-level doctors, right, is such a consuming, experience. I mean, he talks about the fact that he gets to the hospital at 6 a.m. and leaves at 10 p.m. pretty much every day. And a nurse, even one of the nurses that he works with, doesn't even know how much he works, right? You know, there are moments in this book that are interesting to me because they assert a world reality that actually seems quite foreign to me. And I sometimes think, okay, you know, again, this trajectory he was on from doctor to patient, because as a doctor, he thought of himself and he invested quite a lot of time in, you know, being an understanding doctor, one who sat with the patient and made sure that they understood what informed consent was, rather than just, you know, shoving the papers over to them, right? He really tried to explain what was happening in the surgery, what kind of quality of life, and he tried to very much talk with patients about something that Gawande talks about in his last book about end of life, which is one of the things we face when we are dying in this day and age is all these possible medical interventions that will prolong life, but not necessarily prolong it in a way that is meaningful to us. So that one of the things one has to do is figure out, you know, what is meaningful to you? And this is a question that Paul has always, the character, you know, the narrator, you know, describes himself having always been interested in. So he's, you know, here, this doctor who really cares about what's meaningful to his patients and all this. And then he says this thing that I found completely foreign as someone who has been a patient for a long time, and also with a mother who died, you know, in and out of a hospital. He says that doctors in highly charged fields meet patients at inflected moments, the most authentic moments where life and identity were under threat. Their duty included learning what made that particular patient's life worth living and planning to save those things if possible. This idea that this is the most authentic moment, like, I found that so deeply foreign, you know, and I thought, wow, that really speaks in this incredibly powerful way of the dissonance between the experience you have as a doctor before you've gone through this and then the experience you have as a patient going through it. And I don't know what he means. Like, I think he's trying to get it. It's like a highly charged moment, right? But I don't think it's one of the most authentic moments. I think it's actually in some ways a highly inauthentic moment, because you're, as a patient, in this world that's so foreign to you, but it's totally on the doctor's terms, right?
You know, I think these are some of the things, you know, everybody understands the profession in a different way, right? And he's completely, you know, he discusses his as a calling and stuff like that. And I can see how this is how he understands, or had, you know, chose to understand what he does and the people that he meets in those moments.
Slate's audiobook club is also brought to you by Audible.com. Audible content includes more than 180,000 audio programs from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and business information providers. Unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. And one book I would recommend is Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. If you liked When Breath Becomes Air, you will definitely get a lot out of Being Mortal, which touches on the same themes of medicine and mortality. Just go to audible.com/ABC and browse the over 180,000 audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audiblepodcast.com/ABC. That's audiblepodcast.com/ABC and get started today. Yeah, I was also struck by the part when he says, "My highest ideal was not saving lives, everyone dies eventually, but guiding a patient or family to an understanding of death or illness." A part of me, the sort of pragmatist, was saying, all right, philosopher king, if I come to a hospital, I would like your priority to be to save my life, not to help me sort of grok the complexities of what exactly is happening to me physically and spiritually. But I also appreciate that what he meant was, I think that, you know, when his tools as a doctor are failing, there's still more he can do as this person in a kind of privileged position, this doctor with knowledge of the body, and thus I think he thinks of the soul too.
And part of what they're trying to contend with is that they have such a limited amount of time to explain to the family, here's what's happening, here are what your choices are. And to the family, it's still very abstract. But I think for these doctors who are thinking about, you know, what is our responsibility, it starts to feel like they're almost violating the Hippocratic Oath sometimes when they're prolonging life, you know, because the quality of life is just so, it's horrific. Anyway, so that's a really fascinating moment, and I totally get it. It's like, definitely don't want to die. It's a tension that I think is really fascinating as a culture we need to reckon with, which is, right, we don't really want the doctor, they're not priests, like, we don't really want them to be the one to make the decision with us. On the other hand, we kind of need them to think the way that he's trying to think there, because otherwise we end up in these horrific situations.
No, I just wanted to go back to something that you said before, which is, again, like, this is, like, you know, at least I think for most of us, and for me especially, like, a dispatch from a world I don't know and I'm completely unfamiliar with, right? And his relationship to death and the body, I mean, it's constantly changing. This is why are we speculating, but it must change, right? If you're a doctor, you're both, you know, you have to on some level be inured to immense amounts of suffering, but at the same time, you're probably more keenly aware and sensitive to it than other people. You know, that's your terrain, that's your workplace, that's your day-to-day. And I think I was trying to figure out why there have been so many, some of which Megan mentioned in her piece, you know, great essays and books about death and dying. I was trying to figure out why is it that the journalists tend to be so unsentimental. Like, you look at Christopher Hitchens' book Mortality, or Jenny Diskey has a book coming out, Sontag, of course. And I find that the doctors are the ones, like, if you look at Oliver Sacks' last few pieces, or you look at, you know, the moments of this book that feel so much more flooded with feeling and so much more willing to, like, play with some platitudes, or, and not in a cheap way, but in a real way to sort of say that, like, you know, I'm dying and everything seems more vivid, or everything, you know, like these sorts of, and I couldn't quite figure that out. And I think maybe it does come back to that tension between being both so accustomed to it and more sensitive to it than anybody else.
And maybe also that they can't be in denial in quite the same way, you know,
that
he has an amazing thing where he talks about how he accepts the death initially, and then as the treatment works, that's when he kind of goes into some denial. Anyway, Katie, I know you were going
to... Oh, no, I just wanted to read that passage on 121 where he says... death, so familiar to me in my work, was now paying a personal visit. Here we were, finally face to face, and yet nothing about it seemed recognizable. Standing at the crossroads where I should have been able to see and follow the footprints of the countless patients I had treated over the years, I saw instead only a blank, a harsh, vacant, gleaming white desert, as if a sandstorm had erased all trace of familiarity. And I thought that was so beautiful because it got at sort of, he is so acquainted with the night. He's so acquainted with death. And yet death is such a stranger to him from this new perspective. And it throws him back to the days before his medical training. You know, it throws him back to that vast desert in Arizona, the blank, harsh, vacant, gleaming white desert. It sort of strips him of all the intellectual knowledge that he's acquired in the meantime and sends him back there. And he is, you know, equal to anyone who's received a terrible diagnosis like that.
Can we step back for a moment? I would be so fascinated. I know we have to bring it to a close soon, but I would be so fascinated to talk, and maybe this is just my, you know, the hazard of a kind of career obsession with death, but I would be so fascinated to talk about the reception of this book and its context, because one of the things I really thought about as I was writing The Long Goodbye, and that I'm thinking about now that I'm writing about chronic illness, and in both books, one of the things I'm very interested in is the difficulty our culture has in recognizing mortality, grief, illness, these very, very painful topics that there's an almost kind of American, let's muscle through and shy away from it. You know, let's muscle through it, and if we can't, then let's not look too closely at it, right? And I'm very fascinated by how successful this book has been, also in the context of other illness memoir literature. You know, if we think about, you know, so what is it about this book that has made it so successful when others might not have been, you know, and in what kind of doses can we take our lessons about mortality? Like, he has a great image of, you know, patients can only take a tureen of soup at a time, right? They can only take like a spoonful of the tureen at a time, that there's a sense of. So I just wondered what your guys' sense of what it is about this book that made it a bestseller, as opposed to, you know, there's many, many others. And certainly there's wonderful literature, you know, of living with AIDS that helped change that movement and how we saw it and the disease, but it didn't have the same kind of popular. This is a little more on the Tuesdays with Maury kind of level of popularity, right?
I have theories that are charitable and uncharitable, so I will go with my charitable theory first, which is that, you know, there is something very unique about this book in that, you know, you do pick it up because you do. I mean, again, it's like with the Gawande, and there's a personal element, but you also feel like, you know, he will be able to take us even further into this mystery as a doctor and as somebody who studied it. So there's that idea, and there's the idea of like, it is something that it is a death that feels so unfair, you know? I mean, he was so young, he'd worked so hard, and it just, and like the way that the book is also written, and it sort of like very much uses a lot of Christian imagery, a lot of Greek imagery. So it has this idea of, you know, we're standing on a mountain, me and Lucy, and we could see everything, and now it's all being taken from us. And so I think it does, you know, call on sort of, you know, these older themes and sort of like older stories and books. I guess I wonder if like one of the reasons that, you know, it is also so popular is because he is so blameless, you know? Like, it is such a, there's something saintly about this book. There's something saintly about this man. And there's something saintly about the way that he comes across. You know, even though, like, there are moments where sort of he'll confess to sort of, you know, I'm, you know, working too hard and, you know, I'm not able to spend enough time with my patients. But there is something other than that, you know, almost archetypally sort of saintly and about this, like, young, beautiful, heroic man and his wife and all of this sort of this tragedy coming. So I think it sort of might, you know, have an appeal in that kind of way.
Yeah, that's so beautifully said. I also think that there's sort of a quality of irony here, not just tragedy, but irony in the reversals. The doctor becomes the patient, the teacher becomes the student. And there's something there in the sort of overturning of our expectations that adds to our sense of the fragility of life and the mutability of everything that we think is stable. And I think those two sort of strands weave together to sort of make his larger point about mortality really effectively. But I also agree that there's sort of a quality to him as a tragic figure that is especially sympathetic.
And I think in the afterword, his wife mentioned something. I think Lucy says something about, like, I want this book to be for people so that they can see what's coming. Like, I'm bungling this, but, like, that, so when they're in those shoes, they'll be like, okay, this is where I am. These are the sort of choices. These are some of the questions you have. These are some of the decisions you have to make, you know, sort of philosophical and medical and otherwise. So it really does invite people in this particular special way, I think.
Yeah, I think all of that seems so true and illuminating about it. It does strike me too that I was thinking he probably was an amazing doctor, because he kind of is the guide you want, at least in some ways in this moment, because he's trying to think about the meaning of it all, but he's also, you know, and maybe this is a factor of how quick the end came for him, but there's, in a way, it is that spoonful we're given, right? He doesn't overwhelm us with the mortality. So you get these pieces of it, and it's very sad, but there's this redemptive quality of the child and the marriage being kind of saved by the illness in some way. And he has this incredible resilience, honestly, that is kind of comforting. And I think some of the books I've read are just tougher, right, in a way, to read. And there is a kind of, you know, humanistic optimism here that is recuperative.
Yeah, that's beautifully said as well. So I guess we should go around and say whether we would recommend this book. Megan, would you?
Yeah, I would recommend it. And I would actually particularly recommend it to doctors. I think really everyone who works in the healthcare industry should read this book, and others. There are others who should read too. But I think to me, the most important work this book does is this work of trying to synthesize the moral mission of medicine with a very real, firsthand, non-sentimental understanding of the burden that we are, I think the unfair burden that we are placing on doctors today, and the way that understanding led him to have certain insights as a patient, and the way that being a patient led him to have insights as a doctor that he also couldn't always put to use because of the system. So I think that is just a really extraordinary part of this memoir. And I think, for the rest of us, those who read this memoir and like it, there's a lot out there that I would also recommend. But I think this is a very, a good starting place.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I would recommend it for those reasons. And I think also that there's also something really strange and lovely in this book where he sort of talks about how grand illnesses are supposed to be clarifying. But, as we've talked about now, given, certain illnesses and certain sort of medical interventions, he's like, I don't know if I have, 10 weeks, 10 months, 10 years. And so how do I plan for that? And so he has a doctor colleague, friend of his, who tells him, relax, you're trying to figure out your values. And I think that there's lovely stuff in here about figuring out one's values and sort of updating them all the time. And I think that that's something that I found lovely. So yeah, I think it's a beautiful book. And I think that, and as Megan said, I think has so much to say to doctors about what patients need.
Yeah, and I agree with you both. I also think I do stand by the idea that it's a textbook, that it's a work of education, and in some ways he wants to be our Virgil, sort of guiding us not only as a doctor but as someone who treads the path that we all must tread. And there's a generosity to that that I think is incredibly moving and that kind of shines through on every page, really. And it's I sometimes feel like you read books and you expect that only writers write books, and to me, this, maybe because it felt a little unpolished in some ways just because of the constraints of time and circumstance, but I felt like this was a human being writing a book, not like some other species of writer writing a book. And I related a lot to the person behind the prose. And so, yes, I also definitely recommend this book. And with that, I think that is the end of our audio book club. But thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. This was great.
Okay, thanks, guys.
The homepage for the Slate Book Review is slate.com/books. You'll find the show pages for this and every episode of the Audiobook Club at slate.com/ABC. Visit our Facebook page where you can leave a comment on this episode. That address is facebook.com/slateABC. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, which helps other people discover the show. Search for Slate Audiobook Club in the iTunes store and don't forget to leave a comment while you're there. Slate's Audiobook Club is part of the Panoply Network. Find out more about all our great podcasts at panoply.fm. Our producer is Jason DeLeon. Thanks for the assist, Dan Bloom. Slate's executive producer is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is our chief content officer. For Parul Segal and Megan O'Rourke, I'm Katie Waldman. Thanks for listening.